This is Paul. One of the most exciting things to happen in the last year in this space that was sort of an IDW space is sort of the entrance of some new players into this space that I think are important and interesting to follow. And two of the most interesting characters for me recently have been Chris Williamson and Constantine Kissin. I've done a variety of videos on Constantine Kissin before I went on the trip to Europe. This conversation between the two of them I listened to on my way out to Europe, and it was just absolutely outstanding, and I'm going to want to spend some more time on it at some point. But before I do that, I want to spend a little bit more time on Chris. Now, I met Chris at the ARC conference, and I bumped into him in the line going into O2 as well. He's moved to America. I think he's in Austin. I know some of you listen to more of his videos than I have. There's a lot of videos out there to listen to. But I think his channel has grown tremendously. And I think there's a lot of respect for Chris as someone who is really doing an excellent job with these interviews, who is, I think, talking with good faith. And different people play different roles sort of in this internet sphere. And Chris is someone that I think a lot of people can sort of identify with and travel with. He's kind of a travel partner for a lot of people as he's exploring these thinkers. He's asking good questions. He clearly is on his own journey, and he shares his journey with his audience. And so I was super happy to at least get to shake his hand and to tell him what I thought of what he's doing and how I really appreciate him. And so that was super cool. Having said that, let's talk a little bit about Chris and his project. He just recently released a video, 16 lessons in 700 episodes. When he hits a big number with lots of zeros, he likes to sort of go back and go over some of the things that he's learned and how he sort of integrated them into his life. Now, again, I approach the Wisdom Project probably in a different way from what I assume. And if I'm wrong, Chris, I should probably have Chris on the channel. I think he clearly knows who I am. We touch base on Twitter a little bit. My sense of, I don't know about him, but especially his audience, is that most are coming at this project basically from a materialist posture of figuring out how to have your best life now. Now, someone might hear, well, best life now, that actually comes from, some of you know, that comes from, Austin, the prosperity preacher. But your best life now from sort of a secular materialist posture would be to find all the wisdom that you can so that you can construct the happiest, most fulfilling, the life that gives you the best and most consistent best experiences from now until the day you die. And sort of leaves post-afterlife as something that, well, we're not going to talk about it because that's outside the iron box of secularism. And so a lot of the wisdom he is gathering is about this. Now, he begins this video, the first point, which I thought was an excellent point with respect to happiness.
Without further ado, your expectations define your happiness more than your circumstances. And this is something that I knew intuitively, but needed a couple of quotes to kind of really synthesize it. So Tim Urban says, "If you only wished to be happy, this could be easily accomplished. But we wish to be happier than other people, and this is always difficult, for we believe others are happier than they are." Montesquieu said this 300 years ago, and we're still working on this one. So Tim Urban resurfacing that famous quote really highlights the asymmetry between what we see of ourselves and what we see of everyone else, right? Because humans are comparative, relative beings. We don't just judge what we are in isolation. We judge it as a part of the entire hierarchy of society. It's not just about being in a situation and it being good. It's about being in a better situation than we were before, and also a better one than the people that were around, and also a better one than our parents were in. when they were our age. This is an intergenerational competition theory, it's referred to as. Charlie Munger had a really great insight where he said, the world isn't driven by greed, it's driven by envy. Our lives are objectively the best humanity has ever had, yet complaining and dissatisfaction is as high as ever. And also,
now obviously Rene Girard stalks this too, because we are deriving our desires. We don't generate them ourselves. We get them from each other. We're deriving them from each other. And so in this particular context, they are growing. And in fact, the more they grow, the more we're feeding from others, we're comparing to others, and it just keeps going.
So because everyone usually only shows the world the best of themselves, this means that we see our own misery and our failings and foibles and vacillation from a front row seat while we watch the highlight reel of everyone else. And this makes us think that other people are doing better than they really are. And when we feel the delta between where we are and where we imagine they are, it hurts, right? There is no such thing as objective wealth. Everything is relative, and most relative to those around you. That's from Morgan Housel. And there's kind of a way to look at this, that your circumstances are one indication of your happiness, but your expectations are one too. And you can either bring your circumstances up to meet your expectations or try as best you can to bring your expectations down. But the problem is, no one is going to feel fired up or romantic about the opportunity of leaving lots on the table, right? This isn't very hormozy-pilled to say, oh yeah, I'm just going to expect less of myself. I'm going to leave as much as I can on the table because I understand that the gap between my circumstances and my expectations are where happiness sits. So by having lower expectations, I can increase my happiness. That doesn't, it kind of feels like folding almost to this ineffable force that's out there trying to crush us. But I don't know. I think there's something to it, in as much as you can take satisfaction in the things that you have done. I was talking to Dan Bilzerian, someone that you might not think of as a font of like life bro wisdom, but he's a really smart guy. And we were talking about how each time that you achieve a new level of success, it essentially just creates a new bar for you to meet again in the future. And that sounds, I don't know, it might sound kind of trite, but the problem with a rapid increase in status or wealth or accolade or whatever is that all that you're thinking about is, oh God, that's now the new bar that I need to get to. So for instance,
and this very much maps onto Jordan Peterson's meaning and understanding what meaning is and how it works, because meaning isn't actually attaining, holding, and preserving your goal. Meaning is the reaching for the next goal. Just listen to all that Jordan Peterson says with respect to what meaning is and how it's generated, which is why Jordan is always talking about responsibility, dragging that heavy cross uphill to the kingdom of God. Meaning isn't actually attaining the summum bonum, the kingdom of God. Meaning is dragging the cross up the hill to the kingdom of God. And when you look at all of these points that Chris is putting together, you're basically coming into what, let's say, the book of Ecclesiastes says with respect to God has placed eternity in our hearts. Well, what on earth does that mean? And I know that's a particular translation, but I think that idea, whether or not you're going to fight about the translation and whether that's the best way to translate Ecclesiastes 3, is that this is very much who we are. And all of these data points that Chris is sort of pulling together here leads to this. So that if in fact your goal is attainment and not just reaching and striving, but actually possessing, you know, having mode versus being mode, Verveke talks about, if your goal is possessing, the project is gonna yield a kind of thirst that even more attempts to satisfy it will not finally give you what you want. If your main goal is 0 to 80 or 0 to 100, maximizing whatever it is that you think you want.
For instance, let's say that we release a YouTube video and it breaks some record for a 24-hour play. So let's say it does 1 million plays in an hour, which I think in a day, which is around about our current record. There is elation at the fact that we've done it, but then there's also this despondency in the back of your mind where you think, oh my God, that's the new bar. In order for us to get another best record, we have to do 1.1 million plays in a day. And that's terrifying. It's all
and it's also the fact that as you go through life, I mean, Chris is young, he's virile, he's still working on an upward slope, but I hate to tell you, I just hit 60 this year. There are point of diminishing returns. Sometimes we joke when we pull out cameras and we're going to take a picture and someone says, I don't think I look very good. Well, you're not going to look better 5 years from now, odds are. In fact, the age of decay has its way with all of us. And again, depending on the type of goal you have, this impacts. Now, certain kinds of goals are less subject to this kind of decay, but others are. And so what people tend to do is they just sort of keep hopping from hierarchy to hierarchy. But of course, those hierarchies also have their own hierarchy. And
also a reason, I think, why I'm not so bought in on universal basic income being a solution if AI automates all of our jobs and starts producing better podcasts than me, because as soon as humans reach an acceptable level of existence, they start wanting to push for more in order to stand out from the crowd. And a flat hierarchy doesn't stick about for long. So even if every single person earns the same amount of money, people will just find something else to compete on, right? So in 2100, when everyone's needs are met and nobody needs to go to work or something, we're all going to be collecting leaves or wives or social credit score system points or something. Like, you are naturally going to stratify out into a hierarchy because it is not about your absolute happiness. It is all about your relative happiness, your relative attractiveness, your relative wealth. Gad Saad said this on the episode a couple of weeks ago, right? He said, if you want to be happy and satisfied with your sex life, you not only need to have the amount of sex that you want, but you want to be having a little bit more sex than all of your friends around you. So yeah, happiness and satisfaction in life does not exist in a vacuum. As much as you and me may think, oh yeah, fantastic, I can do this from first principles, that's not the way that it works. So yeah, be careful about your expectations. Another one.
That's a huge point, especially when, to me, it seems like the whole project is very much premised on this. Poor dog is getting a little frustrated. As I mentioned before, one of the events that I went to in Edinburgh was an event by Alistair McGrath, where he talked about his latest book on finding Christ through Darwin, which sounds super interesting because in some ways it sort of sounds like the journey that I've been covering over the last 5 years of people finding Christ through Jordan Peterson, except in sort of a different way. This is a book that he's written. He also talked about C.S. Lewis, and this is a book that he wrote earlier, C.S. Lewis, A Life by Alistair McGrath, Eccentric Genius, Reluctant Prophet. And I've been rereading this and really enjoying it and getting into it. And when I was listening to this Chris Williamson point, it immediately made me think of Lewis and his argument for the existence of God from desire. This question of desire was a very big deal for Lewis. And Alistair covers this because for Lewis, it isn't just achieving desire. Lewis also had a strong sense of the distance between our realization and desire is something that is in itself can be desirous. And I think this connects up with Jordan Peterson's sense of meaning. Because meaning isn't actually after you possess it. Meaning is before you possess it. And so what Lewis notes is that there's certainly the striving, which is meaningful, but there's also the longing that is sort of the gap between attainment and desiring a thing that in and of itself has a degree of desirability. Here's a great picture of Lewis. This is Lewis right here. There's his older brother, Warney. This is his cousin. This is another one of his cousins. There's his father holding the family dog. There's his mother or his aunt. I forget which is which, but this is little Lee. Now, of course, Lewis's mother dies when he is young. And so he and his father is unprepared to really fill the void that the mother leaves. And this early wound sends Lewis out on a journey, and it's a journey for joy, and desire is a big piece of this journey. Now I'm going to butcher these Irish names. Now this is a trip I hope to make. I made the trip to Oxford, Lewis, and we played with me getting to Ireland again, and maybe with a trip with more preparation, we could really set up a good Lewis tour in Belfast and Northern Ireland, because this is, of course, where Lewis comes from. From Little Lee, that's Lewis's house that he grew up in. The young Lewis could see the distant, I can't say these Irish words, Castlereagh Hills, which seemed to speak to him of something heartrendingly significant, lying tantalizingly beyond his reach. They became a spirit of liminality, of standing on the threshold of a new, deeper, and more satisfying way of thinking and living. An unutterable sense of intense longing arose within him as he contemplated them. He could not say exactly what it was that he longed for, merely that there was a sense of emptiness within him, which the mysterious hills seemed to heighten without satisfying. In The Pilgrim's Regress, 1933, these hills reappear as a symbol of the heart's unknown desire. But if Lewis was standing on the threshold of something wonderful and enticing, how could he enter into this mysterious realm? Who would open the door and allow him through? Perhaps unsurprisingly, the image of a door became increasingly significant to Lewis's later reflections on the deeper questions of life. The low green line of these hills, although actually quite close, thus became a symbol of something distant and unattainable. These hills were, for Lewis, distant objects of desire, marking the end of his known world, from which the whimper of haunting out of the haunting horns of Elfland could be heard. They taught me longing, sensuch, which made for good or ill, before I was 6 years old, a votary of the blue flower. And then he goes into sensuch and what that means. Looking back on these three experiences, Lewis understood that they could be seen as aspects or manifestations of the same thing, an unsatisfied desire which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. I call it joy. The quest for that joy would become the central theme of Lewis's life and writing. And so on one hand, you can look at what Chris is sort of mapping out there, and from sort of a rationalist point of view, you could say, you should probably give up on this quest for happiness because all of your scientists are saying you can't achieve it. Yet you do. Yet there is a joy and a thrill in continuing to pursue that which you can't necessarily land or acquire or complete, certainly not in this life. So why do you continue to pursue it? It's often the case that we act in ways that are truer than our ability to justify them. So what is the ultimate object of desire, this intense longing? Lewis here anticipates his argument from desire, which is central to the Christian apologetic he would develop further in his wartime radio broadcasts a decade later, and subsequently collect together in Mere Christianity. Lewis opens up with a line of thought originally employed by the French philosopher Blaise Pascal, 1623 to 1662, namely that there is an abyss within the human soul, which is so great that only God can fill it. Or to change the imagery, there is a chair in the human soul, awaiting some guest who has yet to arrive. If nature makes nothing in vain, the one who can sit in this chair must exist. Our experience of this desire both discloses our true identity and intimates our true goal. We initially understand this desire as yearning for something tangible within the world. Then we realize that nothing within the world is able to satisfy our desire. John the Pilgrim initially desires the island. Yet he gradually comes to realize that his true longing is actually for the landlord, Lewis's way of referring to God. This is in The Pilgrim's Regress. All other expectations and proposed goals for this sense of yearning fail to satisfy, intellectually or existentially. They are false objects of desire whose falsity is ultimately exposed by their failure to satisfy the deepest yearnings of humanity. There is indeed a chair in the human soul, and it is intended, and its intended occupant is God. If a man diligently follows his desire, pursuing the false objects until their falsity appeared, and then resolutely abandoned them, he must come out at last into the clear knowledge that the human soul was made to enjoy some object that is never fully given, nay, cannot even be imagined as given, in our present mold of subjective spatio-temporal experience. In the light of Lewis's more mature way of thinking, one further point stands out as being particularly interesting. The Pilgrim's Regress actually describes two journeys, there and back again. You think about Tolkien. Having realized the true significance of the island, the pilgrim now retraces his steps. Yet when the pilgrim walks back through the same landscape after coming to faith, the regress of the book's title, he discovers that its appearance has changed. He sees it in a new way. His guide explains that he is seeing the land as it really is. His discovery of the true state of affairs changes the way he sees things. Your eyes are altered. You see nothing now but realize. Lewis here anticipates one of the leading themes of his later writings, that the Christian faith allows us to see things as they really are. There are strong hints here of some images in the New Testament, such as eyes being opened and veils being removed. And I think, so when I watch this meaning crisis, this quest for wisdom, and when even the... Just a few more minutes, and I will finish up, and we will go home. My dog is desiring something. Talking to him doesn't help, because it just merely means that he wants it even more right now. Yes. Shall I pull you up, and shall everybody get a look at you? Well, maybe after I finish my point. Even when science, which is sort of the guiding wisdom that he is digging out, even when it says, actually, this particular quest cannot be achieved in this world because the goalposts are going to keep getting moved, and they have to be so by virtue of the psychology, yet the quest continues. And I think Lewis and many others began to see, well, maybe we're looking in the wrong place. And when you start looking beyond it, you can actually see what's in front of you in a better life. Or in a better light. That's it for this. I'm going to bring out the dog, and then I'm not going to be able to do much more after the dog, because the dog's been in the crate for a little while I've made two videos, and she's ready to do something else. Here she is. She's not a little puppy anymore. Can you say hi to everybody? Can you say hi to everybody? Yes, 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 yes. Dogs make videos better. They really do. Yes. Yes.